This week on Art of the Air, our whole show features a return visit with the Midwest Museum of Art's director and curator, Brian Byrne, reflecting on his 43-year career there and his plans after retirement at the end of this season. Our spotlight is on Canterbury Theatre's 57th season with the artistic directors, Ray Scott Crawford and David Graham.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight back for another summer season of the Canterbury Theater. Of course, that's located on 807 Franklin Street in Michigan City. And we missed their first show, which was The Effect by Lucy Preble, and that was going to run June 18th through 21st. So we're able to squeeze them in. They can talk to us the rest of the season. Please welcome the artistic directors. We'll just shorten it that way. Ray Scott Crawford and David Graham. Welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's so good to see you.
Well, let's talk about your season that you have coming up. The rest of it, you actually did five shows this season, which I think is an add-on, but let's talk about the remaining things that you have on the calendar.
All right, well, the next thing actually opens today, and it's A Year with Frog and Toad, and it is the delightful musical based on the books that everyone loves, and we did it a number of years ago, probably about 13 years ago, and it was a big success then. So we're pulling it back and doing it again, whole different cast, and I think the audiences are really going to love the humor and it's just a nice show. I don't know if you're familiar with the books, but they're just delightful. Stories about a year spent from the eyes of a frog and a toad who are the best of friends. Some say it's a children's show. I say it's an everybody that's a child at heart show.
I agree with that.
What do we have next?
David, what's up? What do you have next, David?
Next coming up is that we have Baby, and it is a musical by Maltby and Shire, who are considered pretty legendary Broadway composers, and it takes a musical look at three couples that are in various stages of becoming parents. There's an older couple, that it was totally unexpected, and it was a middle couple who've been really trying, and they're, you know, young professionals, and then there's a couple that are students. So it takes a look at each of them as they prepare for parenthood.
Wildly and different dynamics.
Wildly different. And one thing about the show itself is fairly has been around for a while. We did a first version back in like 98, but Maltby and Shire went back in a couple of years ago and they revised the show for new generations. So it will be like a newer version of the show. So we're excited about that. Ray Scott.
Oh, real quick, I just wanted to comment. Baby has been one of my favorite shows. I remember when my daughter was a baby. My wife worked on the show at Purdue Northwest, well, Purdue Calumet then.
Okay.
And I remember how much I really loved that show. I mean, I'm curious about what they would do to update it. But that's going to be a real exciting one to have. Ray Scott, what's the next one you got?
The next one up is The Mad Ones, and it is exciting. In fact, I saw it in Chicago, I don't know, about 4 or 5 years ago, I think, maybe 3 years ago. But it is a small show, and it's sort of a nostalgic mind trip. A girl is graduating from high school. She's getting ready to make decisions about what she's going to do for the rest of her life. Her mother wants her to, you know, go to college and be the, you know, find a career. And she's hearing voices from her past that are telling her to just go out into the world and make her own way. And she faces a lot of internal struggle, at the same time, a lot of uplifting, life-reinforcing choices as well. The music is delightful. It reminds me, I don't know if you're familiar with Spitfire Grill, but it has sort of that homespun feeling to it that is it's sort of magical and creative and folksy, I think is a good way of putting it. This will be a first time for Canterbury to do The Mad Ones, and we're excited about that.
Very, very, very nice show. Our final show of the season will be Laundry and Bourbon by James McClure. And this is a very charming, quaint show. It's about three women sitting on their porch in small town Texas in the 1970s. And they're three friends that get together, of course, to, you know, talk about the gossip and rumors in town. But then something happens where one of them finds out that they're the source of some of the rumors and gossip. And it's a very funny show.
Yeah, it's very, very funny.
It's very funny. So, that'll wrap up the season for us.
Do you have season tickets?
Yeah, yes, we have season discount cards that get you 5 admissions. It's $90 for 5 admissions.
And how can they, what's the best way to get tickets?
Well, you can do it two ways. You can call the box office at 219-874-4269. Or you can email us at info@canterburytheater.org. And you can always visit our website at canterburytheater.org.
And can they order tickets directly from the website?
This time. Okay. Not at this time. We're hoping to install that at some point in the future, but we're still working on it. So right now it's by phone or email.
Great. Well, that's Ray Scott Crawford and David Graham. They're the artistic directors of Canterbury Theater, canterburytheater.org. You can find out information about the shows. Their season is their 57th season. And of course, a mainstay of Michigan City. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're looking forward to another great season. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Art in the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by McCauley Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker.
This is Clay Jenkinson for Listening to America, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are overjoyed to welcome back the magical Brian Byrne to Art on the Air. We first spoke on February 9th of 2024. Brian has served as the curator of exhibitions and education for the Midwest Museum of American Art since 1981, changing the visual landscape of the museum. We've asked him back to talk about his history with the museum, the 46th anniversary, and turning the reins over to the wonderful Randy Roberts, plus what mischief or adventure is next. Aloha and welcome. Welcome, Brian. Always terrific seeing you.
Yes, thank you. Again, I've returned with more stories from the front.
Unlike our previous interview where we ask you about your origin story, they can hear that one on our February 9th interview. But we want to talk about what's coming up, some of the things going on in your life, and of course, your imminent retirement. Of course, as you know, I failed retirement and I'm doing this. So I understand there's life, there's more life sometimes after what you've been doing for many years. And so anyway, we want to hear about what you're going to be, what you're finishing up doing, the transitions there and things you have planned after you walk out the door.
Well, certainly I've been involved with looking back at 43 plus years. And by the time I reach my retirement point at the end of this year, I will have served 44 years, which that ties me with the second longest serving curator of American art and American art history. And that other person, the late Clyde Singer, served 44 years in a capacity as curator for the Butler Institute of American Art, located in Youngstown, Ohio. And I've always admired that kind of longevity. And in my early years, I could have never thought that I would spend 4.5 nearly decades at this post, although I knew that every day was something challenging, every day was something new and interesting. And I certainly was using the rudiments of my undergraduate degree that I talked about in the last interview. And I was adding to that a lot, learning certainly on the job, but also being presented in certain situations where, I was asked to attend conferences and the like to upgrade my skill set, to upgrade my knowledge, and being a reader certainly of the American art history. When I arrived, of course, there was two books on the shelf about American art history. And in the lifespan of this museum, which in May will celebrate 46 years of existence here on this corner of the world, this pied-à-terre in downtown Elkhart, corner of Marion and Main Street, in the lifespan of this museum, we have seen, or at least I've been witness to, the rising scholarship of American art history. So now what was once just two books, well, in our library, and there are many other types of books, but we have nearly 4,000 books, probably over 250 on the subject of American art history. So that's been very gratifying. So I feel like I've kind of lived along the stream of life here.
You've charted the course for it, though.
Yes. Thank you. That's nice of you to say that. I think certainly with this institution, there were things set into motion that I just came into. And then certainly I helped in the propensity of forward motion and acquiring more. When I got off the bus down here, well, in Elkhart, you'd say when I got off the train, there were 224 works of art in the permanent collection. And at that moment, I had been introduced to the general public and to the membership as the best of show winner in the third Elkhart Juried Regional. So this fall will mark the 47th Elkhart Juried Regional. And with that introduction, literally the spotlight that shone on my face, 5 weeks later, I was brought in on an interview to replace two departing curators who were leaving under good demeanor to new jobs, to ratchet up their careers. But that was a situation where there was no permanent collection. So,
oh, Brian, don't you hang more than 250 pieces in that juried show?
Oh, yeah. At least, several hundred a year, transition. That's right. So I think in the early years that juried regional we were speaking of was only 10 counties. Today it's 24 counties. It covers the northern tip of Indiana and the four southwestern Michigan counties. Yes, so it was kind of a shocker to walk in the first and see my artwork hanging there. And it'll be a shocker again because I'll be planning a 45-year retrospective of all those best of shows. So that'll be the one point you'll get to see an early Brian Byrne work. And we call it Made in Michiana. Every 5 years, we trot those out so the public can look at that piece of art history in our region. Yeah, so that, in the event, that was shocking. And by the May of 1982, we established a platform of permanent collection. And then I established a docent program. And from there forward, we took that docent program into, you know, just until a few years ago when I just could not sustain it. And unfortunately, some of my really chartered docents have passed on now, and others have sought retirement. And the changing landscape of attractions are such that I felt like when I retire, a new person will reinvent that program. And indeed, we've recently hired a new assistant curator of education, and that she's going to be tasked with that very thing. So that's just some of the... Looking back, looking forward, like a Janus figure, you know, I always look back and say, well, we did it this way. How can we do it better? How can we do it differently? How can we add some new energetic voices to this? And certainly Jennifer Abril has helped me source those people out of interviews and kind of look at things from a perspective that means that, you know, what two people could do, the very competent and comparable Randy Roberts as curator, as my assistant curator, and now curator, we formed a curatorial team. And I may linger, my ghost may linger here afterwards.
Are you listening, Randy?
I'll be like Bob Marley shaking my chains at him. Wake up, we need to move this piece over here to this wall.
Well, you're an expert at that.
Brian, one question I have for you, with such a long career there, and looking back at that, is there something that you wanted to do over the years that you didn't get a chance to do at the museum? Or have you think you got everything you wanted done?
Oh, no. Well, there's probably more than one thing. What immediately comes to mind to me is with the collection now growing to around 6,800 works, one thing we're going to implement, and matter of fact, tomorrow afternoon, we have our first curatorial meeting implementing a new software that organizes the collection. It will take a few years to fully document all of the works, even though everything is documented in hard copy files, to input it, to photograph it. So this new Past Perfect program is going to be something that I'll at least get to see in its early stages as we launch it. The second thing that I have not been as successful with but would like to see is organizing, and there are a few traveling exhibits of the museum's collection, but I'd like to see that more fully realized and implemented because there are more small museums in this country than large museums. Maybe there's 50 mega-sized museums with millions, if not budgets approaching, you know, $1 billion. But for us small institutions, we need to be able to network more and share. And I feel that we have many parts that could be put together in such a way that would make it cost-effective, efficient, and also kind of share this cultural material. I don't know if in my first interview I quoted that infamous statistic now, but in the what is known as the American Alliance of Museums, there seems to be about 18,000 institutions. In my earlier statistics, it said, oh, there were around 15,000. And there were a little over 10,000 that were art museums. But of those 15,000, the statistics went, and it could be similar today, 15,000, 87% of those museums were small museums. Now, Esther's probably wondering, what is a small museum? And Larry says, well, don't you know that a small museum is a museum that has a budget of $250,000 a year or less. And you can do all that on that. Well, a lot have to, and a lot rely on volunteers, as we have in the past too, certainly. But with that 87% of the 15,000 with budgets of $250,000, they had management over 97% of America's cultural properties. So how do you maintain all that? How do you maintain the brick and mortar, pay the staff, let alone, you know, try to educate and preserve that? So it's difficult.
And add to it.
Yes. So you know, I think that as we go forward, some of the things that I have not realized was a way to share our collections and to share our programming in such a way that makes it cost-effective, affordable. I mean, I don't even think our friends, the other museums, other than perhaps the Racklin Murphy Museum, which is an academic institution supported by the University of Notre Dame, they may be able to afford larger budgets for traveling shows. But when you get over $10,000, and most traveling exhibits are in the range of $50,000 to $100,000 for a small kind of traveling show, it's difficult to find those kind of sponsors. So fortunately, we've reorganized our finances and created funds that will help support those ideas of bringing in at least one major outside show a year, helping preserve the collection as it exists and add to it, of course, and certainly provide programming and support. So maybe in my dotage and in my retirement, I might be called upon to be, you know, to actually deliver a traveling exhibit from the Midwest Museum's collection to some small museum in Southern Indiana. I don't want to drive over 200
miles. Curator Roadie.
Right. I would be a road dog for sure. So, but that's one thing. That's a big thing. And I just want to, you know, I think our founders too had this vision of sharing, you know, beyond just the confines of the art world, beyond the academic art world, sharing with the broad basis of public original works of art, providing some kind of guided programming to help build that appreciation and understanding. So I guess I still have a little gas left in the tank. But
well, you brought up about financing, and I just curious about, well, as you well know, and the Indian Arts Commission just took a 30% reduction in their funding, how you see how that might impact your financing. It looks like, you know, I mean, I don't know if you own the building, or maybe explain that whole thing. Maybe your financing, maybe it won't be as your museum may not have as much impact as does on smaller venues.
Well, it certainly has an impact in terms of if we want to support other institutions and their efforts that help, you know, buoy us all up, you know, the tides raise all ships, that kind of thing. But it has minimal, if any, impact on the Midwest Museum. Long ago, the labor-intensive nature of writing grants seemed too much for a staff of 2 to 3 people. And so I spent most of my time with my predecessor, the late Jane Burns, in our community and expanding that community through the juried regional outward and inviting artists and learning about artists from other communities and making contacts. So that kind of sourcing out or insourcing help through first purchase awards and then perhaps memberships and later donations have really escalated for us. Now, we don't have buckets of money. And my co-director is fond of saying that, well, if money was no object, Brian, and we had buckets of it, we would just, you know, just replace that north wall with a beautiful marble exterior of Indiana limestone exterior. But we can't always do what we want to do. So I think that the Indiana Arts Commission in taking a hit, as all of those types of institutions throughout the states. I know there's a lot of hubbub right now at the federal level about the IMLS being eradicated or stripped down, and the Indiana or the National Endowment for the Humanities, let alone the National Endowment for the Arts. It's a trouble, you know. If you're in business, Larry, and you're a big time business, and you start looking around for budget cuts, where do you go? You know, you start cutting out what you think are the unnecessary or the you know, the parts that, well, we could still survive if we brought it down to this in hopes that the markets got better and we could rebuild it back up. I don't know. This seems to be more permanent and detrimental. It may be a long lasting effect. And I'm for all of the arts in every way, shape, and form. And I think that's what gives everybody an opportunity to reinvent themselves.
Well, and artists are historically innovative, so there will be, they'll be shifting, and
And I guess, you know, we'll survive. Maybe I don't think we can say we got too comfortable, because I remember the arguments in the late 60s when someone went out on a hill and took a load of TNT and blew up 2 tons of clay and called it a work of art, and that just enraged senators and congressmen and so on and so forth. And that will continue, because artists do challenge us. Artists do mirror our society. And right now I have a great show called Politics and Religion. Is that not provocative enough, Esther? I mean, really, that alone will bring people in, and we have a big banner over our door. And the only thing I would have changed, it says, come join us. And I would have said, come join our party.
Well,
because
it's a
celebration of artists speaking out. So,
well, and also, you know, you'll be showing a movie, Art in War. And even in these situations, I had friends in Vietnam who, even if it was raining, they still sketched and tried to keep their work dry and brought it home. You know, it's just, I mean, you just can't stop it.
No, it's cathartic, and it's important, you know, and a pencil is a very portable tool, and you can draw on anything. And Robert Rauschenberg once said, I can draw a painting or a picture in the air.
Right.
And he erased a Willem de Kooning drawing to prove how, you know, little regards he had for the act of creation itself. But I think that you're right. And our film will be about the National Gallery of London during World War II, because that coincides with an exhibit I put together of some of our Gabor Petterdy etchings. Mm-hmm. And we have the largest public. I'm going out on a limb here, Larry. Help me. I'm going out on a limb. But we have the largest public collection of Gabor Petterdy's etchings, works in general, in the United States, outside of Yale. Now, I wouldn't count Yale as a public collection. I count that as the largest and the oldest university collection. But thanks to one Dr. Stephen Conant, who since 1993 became not only a patron and a donor and a friend to the Midwest Museum, and I call him my friend too, he has given us nearly 1,500 works in all of those Gabor Petterdy pieces. And so it's amazing, because historically Gabor Petterdy is one of two of the most important printmakers, other than Bill Tortolotti, if he's listening. Well, two of the most important printmakers in American art history. And he came from Hungary. He was born there. He studied at age 17, 18, 19 years old in Paris with Stanley William Hayter. And for 27 years after the war, World War II, he taught at Yale University. So the Yale University Art Galleries owns around 189. I haven't checked it lately, works by Petterdy. But when we boasted, thanks to Steve Conant, that we had 89, and we did a major national show and took out a little advertising to to put it out there in Art in America in black and white, couldn't afford color. But we had calls from all over the country, you know, and all of a sudden, when I went back to Yale University's searchable database, I found like, well, they must have really shaken their alumni up and said, hey, we need some more Pederdys because this little museum out on the prairies of northern Indiana is taking us to task on this. I don't know. But yeah. but that covers a lot of ground there. So over to you again. Give me another topic.
Well, you're listening, by the way, to our audience on Art in the Air, Brian Byrne, the director and curator of the Midwest Museum of American Art on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. And we'll return to our guest after a brief pause. Art in the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show, whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners? Email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. We return to our guest today on Art of the Air, Brian Byrne, who is the director and curator at the Midwest Museum of Art.
So what about you personally, Brian? Have you been able to delve back into your own artwork? I mean, and I wonder, when you're on holiday too, are you able to do some? I mean, you've sent me some pretty mighty fine images, you know, when you're away.
Yes. Well, you know, I make that a rule of thumb. You know, my wife and I, when we've been visiting Mexico for the last two decades, and I can't just sit idly by in the sun because I'm at least part Irish and a little Welsh, and so that's not good for me. But I do paint and draw. And that's my time kind of focused on that activity. And I do research, you know, via my phone, and we're all very connected. But yes, I do smaller versions, portable versions, and I think last year I did 47 drawings and watercolors in about a 16-day period. So it gives me that feeling of intense studio practice. Like every day I can get up, I can have a little, you know, a little something for breakfast and a shot of tequila and go out to my portable Caribbean studio and set up. And I have certain ways of setting myself up a sort of a task list for that day and how many I will do. And I hope that in the future I'll go back to that again, you know, not to be a second or third career, but certainly just you've got that impetus, that feeling inside, you got to draw. I was a drawing major, art history and painting minor. My master's is in education with an emphasis in art. And so certainly studio practice is near and dear to my heart, but you need time to reflect, you need time to do. And so where I was once creating large scale figurative drawings, I mean, you know, a basic sheet was 40 by 60 inches, maybe. Mm-hmm. I've scaled down. I've had to. I don't have the energy level.
Well, you know, I would come to a workshop in Mexico taught by you. I would do it. I'd be on that plane.
Hey, now that's a thought. You know, I think late Jan Sullivan of the Art Barn used to haul all of her constituents down somewhere down in Mexico, and they had a little retreat enclave. So that might be something.
Yeah, sign
that
me up.
Podcasting. And Larry said he's going to help me learn how to podcast. So you might have to have three screens. But thank you. Yes, well, that's a possibility. There's, to me, retirement is just endless possibilities. And I think work helps me focus, particularly on the administrative duties and on the curatorial duties and helping staff move up and me move out of their way so they can accomplish new things, new goals. But I have a lot of ideas about what I'm going to do. And I may take the first 6 months off and do nothing except sit on the porch and watch the sunset with my dog.
There is merit in doing that, too.
Well, that's refreshing. That's sort of a palate cleanser.
Yeah, that's right. If it, you know, the stopgap between, you know, the next thing. But who knows? Yes, I've been asked to think about, and I would never do this while I was an employee of the Midwest Museum of American Art, show my work here. And so I've been giving some thought to what a retrospective might look like. And certainly I have work trailing back all the way to 1981, to that first best of show, and a few pieces still left hanging about that are in that same genre. So I'll be thinking about that, and who knows, you might get an invitation to see, you know, Brian Burke, four and a half decades in the making.
You know, Brian, I may have asked you this on your first interview, I can't remember, but is there any kind, now that you're going to be probably free to do more art, is there any kind of art that you would like to do that you haven't done?
Oh, gosh, well, yes, you know, after watching artists grow and develop, and certainly through the juried regional, having artists bring works and coming and going, whether they're graduate students and or they're anchored in this area, there's some things, yeah, I would like to, I might even take audit some courses. You know, I mentioned Bill Tort a lot early. I'd like to work with him in some printmaking capacity. There's a couple poetry classes taught at IUSB, and certainly Ramiro Rodriguez and his wife Lori Russo have the Taylor Street Studios. They're printmakers, and so monotypes are something I'm interested in. I did a short blast of those back in the early 90s, and I really enjoyed that. I didn't enjoy so much the step-by-step process of etching and learning all those things. And then also, my friend Bill Kramer, I told him I'd like to haunt him a little bit in his retirement as a ceramic artist professor at Notre Dame and make some clay again. I really loved clay when I was a young person, but I never chose that as my path, unfortunately, maybe. Because right now you might have been talking to one of the famed Michiana pottery tour artists like Dick Lehman, although I don't think I could have ever matched Dick's prowess, and he or Justin Rosshank, either one. They're great beyond potter ceramic artists like Bill Kramer and certainly Mark Gertzen. So we're blessed with a lot of great artists that I'd like to sidle up with and see if I could do that, you know, learn that or something. I only have a short time left on this rock, so I have to kind of mediate what all those things. So, but
where you want to put your energy. So I don't know if this is, you don't have to give away any secrets if this is giving away secrets, but with the juried regional, are there plans to go digital in the future?
That's all going to be determined by the next crew that steps on board. I don't know how that will go. Since I'll be involved, this should be my last juried regional. I felt like, at least my colleague Randy Roberts, felt like we ought to kind of continue on. We know how to work it. And then as he adds the two new, and we'll have some new hands and eyes on this, the two new assistant curators to help. Yeah, there might be a possibility, but I won't weigh in on that yet. So I do it the old-fashioned way. I like to look at the art right up close and personal.
I know. And if there's something really special about bringing it in too, I don't know. It's like a mini reunion.
And you get to talk to, and that's a touchstone for the staff, and there'll be more staff, and how will these younger staff members ever know who this 50, 60, 70, last year the oldest artist was 94, you know, who these artists are and who, what they have contributed. You know, you learn stories along the way, and I would like to help maybe arrange some of that for some of these artists, so I might be dovetailing back into, you know, future, just promoting, oh, talk to this artist, you know, before, because they were so important at some point or another.
While you're talking about that exhibit, when is the call for art for that juried show? And
that should be going out sometime around August 1st. That's what we always say. Last year, I believe Randall had it a little bit ahead of schedule, about mid-July. But we're working on, I have the two judges already selected for this year. I think both of these people will be absolutely outstanding. They're both excellent artists, and they have both been teachers. So I think they have some nurturing qualities to their judgment process, you know, their subjective judgment process. And
are they from two different facilities, or are they from the same?
Yes.
Okay.
They're from two different areas and two different disciplines.
Oh,
one
excellent.
Has a graphic design background and teacher, and also is an administrator of a small university art gallery in his capacity as a professor. And the other taught figure drawing and painting and is an award-winning artist and has been a past Best of Show winner at the Midwest Museum of American Art before he moved on. So I was very pleased to source out these two gentlemen, and that they, and the judging will, I can tell you conclusively, the judging process will take place on Sunday, September 14th. So we're just working out the calendar before that. But somewhere around August 1st, you'll get the call and download the materials, look it over, fill it out, and then sometime after, maybe immediately following Labor Day, we'll begin the entry process, bringing the entries. Yeah.
Ah. And what type of art do you usually have in your exhibit for the juried show?
Oh, it's all media. We never know. We brace, you know, just in terms of numbering, how many numbers. Last year was a near record number. I think there were 267 artists brought, and the year before was 219. So that additional number of artists bringing, and they're asked to bring one or two. I think 85% brought two works. So, you know, that alone prepares you to figure out how you're going to temporarily store and handle each. And it's all media. And so long ago, I think, Larry, when I turned 50, I decided I can't lift 150 pounds anymore. I can only lift 100 pounds. So I'm going to lower. But now Randy, I think he could lift 150 pounds by himself, but I didn't want to break his back either. So since we have to manage and handle these, we have a limit of size, 7 feet in either direction and 100 pounds. So
excellent.
So, and it'll be a lot. I think that was over 450 works of art to manage. And when you figure you handle each one six times, do the math.
At least.
That's a big inventory.
You don't have to go to the gym that way.
That's right. That's maybe what I'll miss the most out of now we're here. It's, you know, I've always been a working director, so there's a certain physicality to this job. I would like to sit in my ivory tower and think only really great thoughts about things and conceptualize, but sometimes I have to get out there and really put forth the elbow grease, as they say, to get things done, you know. And hanging that show, installing that show is a huge process.
Right.
So.
Excellent. Well, you're listening to Brian Byrne, director of the curator, Midwest Museum of American Art, on Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So what's on the agenda for tomorrow?
Wow, tomorrow's another day, Esther, as they say. Well, tomorrow we're going to, try to implement the Past Perfect software inventory process. We're going to be open to the public. Now, we do have some new hours with the new year going forward. So now the museum open to the public Wednesday through Friday from 11 to 5. And we've also extended an extra hour on the weekend, so we're open 1 to 5 Saturday and Sunday. And so we're onboarding staff where Randall and I don't have to work every other weekend. That's a plus. And tomorrow, you know, we'll look at the 46th anniversary and start implementing some stages of planning for what's going to take shape on Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. And we're going to feature a really wonderful and kind of a rock star, at least in the local scene. Celia Weiss is going to be performing on the piano. And we're going to honor Dr. Stephen Conant. So Friday, I'm going to go retrieve him from Indianapolis. He's had a few health issues and can't drive extended distances. So I've offered to come and extract him from Indy and bring him back up here. And unfortunately, he's got some good friends who will take him back on Sunday. So we're going to be preparing for all of that 46th anniversary celebration, you know. So
Wow. So I have a personal question, which, you know, you can certainly not answer. So your lovely wife is such a huge support, but is she also an artist? Does she have a practice?
She is not. She is not an artist. I don't know that I could be married to an artist. They're so difficult. No, I'm just kidding. There's only room for one artist in this house. No, I'm not like that at all. But she's a very creative person. She bakes. She's culinary, you know, delights are extraordinary. And she's
well known.
And she's sort of hung up her chef's hat as caterer for the museum, you know, and she's happy about that. She gets a little break. She's a voracious reader. While I'm making 47 watercolors, she's read 15 books. I struggle to get through one or a half of one. I read in short bursts. And so she's all that. And she also manages, you know, our business affairs. So she's very good at that. Not that I couldn't, but it's easier when there's someone else. You can put this on their desk and say, fix this for me. And that's where Jennifer comes in, my co-director. Hey, we need to fix this. And then I get boomerang back into it somehow. But no, that's so Lisa has been wonderful as a volunteer. And she's mentioned, I should say, and I'll get you both a copy of our new annual report, which will really give numbers and depth to our activities, at least in 2024. And I think moving forward, we can expect to see at least a digital version, but a hard copy as well of an annual report. That really puts the proof. When I read it, when I looked through it as our graphic designer had sourced it out, I got a little teary, I have to tell you. I mean, it really makes you feel like, wow, we really did do all that.
Yeah,
you
know, we made a difference.
When you see it concrete like that, I guess. So
it's that's kind of me as a visitor to the museum, you know, I've brought many friends. And the testament is also on those walls with that permanent collection.
Well, you know, thank you. Other than you're just your ray of light that you brought to the museum, I think, years ago, and your really exciting and interesting work that was witnessed by when you gave a gallery talk, I think people were just astounded by your practice. And well, thank you. Yes, you know, the collection is phenomenal. I mean, for a city, 53,000, to have amassed this type of collection, and it's due to just a few, which will be mentioned in our annual report. The key family was the Burns family, Dr. Richard D. and Jane Burns. They cast the die. They set the pace. American art. They gave 47 pretty major works for any museum to own. And then Dr. Conant, 1,500 works, adding in historical footnotes and sidebars and filling full gaps. I mean, you know, he's just a phenomenal collector. Doug Grant and Karen Grant recently gave an extraordinary collection of American art pottery to the museum. all of which is on display right now throughout the main gallery, a new custom case, the Overbeck collection of the Overbeck sisters.
Oh my gosh, I'm so in love with them.
Largest in the country, yeah, if not the world. And it's just those individuals, you know, those works could have been scattered to the four winds. But they came to rest here on this corner of the world, and we've maintained this now 100-plus-year-old building. And we continue to maintain it, and it's an artifact unto itself, but it's in pretty good health. We're working on improving that for the next 50 years. And that's what's so phenomenal, that we've had this facility that started with a dream. The Burns had this dream. They drove by this former bank building. They said, this could be a museum. This would be a good place to start a museum. If you have more millionaires per capita than any city in the country, and population 30,000, then there should be a lot of people interested in, you know, promoting the visual arts and learning about their own American heritage. Well, a few of them did, and were pleased, because other museums have lined up to want and ask for pieces that ended up here in our collection. So yeah, it's a treat. It's stupendous.
If someone wanted to donate their artwork, whether it be an artist or maybe their estate, would you be interested in that? Would they, if they approached you about someone who had a body of work and adding to your collection?
Yeah, I think in the past, Rand and I, and then the late Jane Burns and I, kind of formed our own policies on collecting. But we're going to have new set of policies, and perhaps, well, I know we'll have a new committee that will review, and then it will be left up to trustees. Because after you reach 6,800, you have to start to think about how can you properly care for what's really relevant and important to what we already have, what we might have to get rid of to make room for new works.
Because at this point, it's about enhancement. You know, you just really...
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Be careful.
I think if somebody comes along and offers me a George O'Keefe, I'll say, well, like Dick Brower, I'll say, I'll drive around and put it in my trunk and I'll bring it back. So that's the story. How he got that from Chicago. He said, I just put that in my trunk and drove it back to Valparaiso. Yeah. So I don't think that's going to happen. There are things out there that I think that will come along that will need to be a part of our story. And that's really it, right? This is all about telling stories and making it appealing to not just the acolytes of American art and the academics of American art, but to everybody. How does your story work here? And there's a story at all levels in visual arts, right? Esther, you know, there's stories right outside of your door right now happening, you know, and the regional points that out.
Well, we have like about 2 minutes left, and I was going to ask you a couple things. One, sure. I asked you what you want to do artistically, but is there something you want to do non-artistically in your retirement that you say, oh, I've never been able to do? What is that?
You mean like a bucket list?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
You know, I can't really think of anything. It just feels like when I was 23 and stepped into this role, I thought I had done about everything there was to do, and I could prepare myself to be a starving artist and live in Chicago, probably on the streets of Chicago. But now, as I get older, there's more and more I learn that I don't know. So I guess, you know, I just want to keep learning about anything, and everything is interesting. I had a great mentor who was like that. And he could talk about a lot of different subjects. And he wasn't just a jack of all trades. He would read, and he was very thoughtful and conversational. And we had these long, long, hour-long, before Lisa and I were married, I called them my postgraduate years with Jonas Howard in Florida, in Sarasota, Florida. And we'd go look at exhibits and talk about them. So I think the leisure that will be allowed to me to visit other museums and visit other artist studios, that's really something that I've been longing to do. and have not had a chance to do. That's still within the realm of art, but there might be other things too. A guy has invited me to a chili festival, not making eating chili, but chili pepper festival that I met, who was the person in charge of an artist, Bonnie Rock's nephew, Ted Wagner. And so I thought, yeah, I'd like to check that out.
Is that in Texas? I read about one in Texas.
It's in Indianapolis.
Oh, my gosh. Well, so much easier to get to.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe that'd be my launching pad to Santa Fe.
Brian, real quick, tell us where the museum is for audience.
Oh, thank you for that. We are at downtown Elkhart, 429 South Main Street, diagonally across from the Lerner Theater. You can't miss us. We're the other half of the Arts and Entertainment District in downtown Elkhart. And you can check out our website at midwestmuseum.org. It's been upgraded, and there's just so much to explore there. You can email us, you can call us, all that information's online. So,
well, we thank you for coming back on Art in the Air. That's Brian Byrne, director and curator of the Midwest Museum of American Art, and coming back to share his story here on Art in the Air. Thank you so much for coming back and sharing your art journey and also what's going on in the future.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Esther. It's always a pleasure. You guys do a great job and a great service to the Michiana region.
And it's always a pure joy talking to you, Brian, and especially seeing you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker, and for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art on the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry are on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Are on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.